Senator Menard, Senator Elias, and Senator Jones are present. On our schedule today, we have House Bill 411. It's appropriation bill, Exxon Valdez restoration project. House Bill 296, protection of native human remains. House Bill 207, village safe water program. And various other pieces of legislation deal with the same thing as 411. Well, let's take up House Bill 411 first. We have a committee substitute for us.
You ready?
Ready for a motion to...
Mr. Chairman, I move and ask the members to consent that Senate committee substitute for committee substitute House Bill number 411 resources be adopted and the original bill.
All right. Any objections ordered?
Chairman?
Any discussion on the bill?
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah.
I move and ask unanimous consent that Senate bill, Senate committee substitute for committee substitute House Bill 411 resources be moved from committee with individual recommendations.
Any objections ordered? Let's take
House Bill 296, protection of native human remains. 298. Spending $50 million
in, yeah,
that's 50 seconds or less.
My name is Stephanie Love. I'm staff to Representative Davidson. The legislation introduced, Representative Davidson introduced this legislation to address problems the Alaska Native community has had with repatriation of their ancestral human remains. Many of you have probably followed the controversy surrounding the recent return of Alaskan Native remains to the village of Larson Bay on Kodiak Island from the Smithsonian Institute. The return of approximately 800 skeletons and 150 artifacts brings to an end the long battle between the village of Larson Bay and the Smithsonian Institute over who has ownership of the burial goods removed in the 1930s by a Smithsonian Institute anthropologist. The passage of House Bill 296 will prevent such an incident from occurring again in Alaska. Currently, Alaskan statutes do not give clear direction on how human remains should be handled. It is Representative Davidson's hope that this legislation will speak to the concerns of all interested parties while bearing in mind that human remains are not possessions. This bill sets out guidelines for individuals to follow that discover remains accidentally and also gives direction to those that find human remains and associated burial goods while undertaking permitted archaeological digs. Mr. Chairman, the legislation simply allows the descendants or members of the closest tribal group to repatriate their ancestral remains. This bill gives them the choice to allow for the study of the remains prior to repatriation if they choose.
Questions? Does this deal with artifacts also?
It deals with associated burial goods, and the attempt is to address those remains, those burial goods that are found with remains.
The definition of human remains. Remains are in page 4.
Is there such a thing as some of the natives? Do they dig up any of the artifacts at all that are used for sale purposes, for, you know, some way to supplement their incomes or anything like that?
Does this legislation address that? Is that what you're saying?
Does this prevent that?
Well, there is current law, the Alaska Historical Preservation Act,
mm-hmm.
that deals with those types of things. It's a Class A misdemeanor to remove those type of archaeological effects on state land.
And this doesn't affect that at all?
It separates the definition, the resource definition, and separates human remains and associated burial goods. And gives direction that the next of kin or tribal group is contacted and allowed to participate.
Okay. Any questions? Okay.
Thank you.
Carol Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Davidson, you want to come up to the table? It is, we're on your...
Thank you, Senator.
Legislation.
On the body bill.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm Carol Wilson with the Department of Natural Resources. The department supports the intent of this bill, and we understand the situations that arose that people want to do something about. But we would need money to do the many things in this bill, but we also have a lot of concerns about it still. We worked with the sponsor on it, but there are a lot more things that we think need to be taken care of. Just some of our general concerns are that right now, the way it works is that we have in our State Historic Preservation Office, Office of History and Archaeology, we have some archaeologists, people who have issue permits for archaeological work and so on, but they're responsible for state land. The State Historic Preservation Officer has this kind of dual federal and state role. Now, if human remains are found on state land, usually it's a DOT construction project or something like that, DOT, through an RSA, will pay our folks to come out because construction work has to stop and figure out what to do. What they do is coordinate. The State Historic Preservation Officer or her folks contact local native corporations, organizations, community, to try and figure out the best way to dispose of what is found. And they're not statutorily responsible for doing this, which makes a big difference. If you're required to do something in law, there's a lot more things that you have to do than if you're not required to do it. Plus, you can be sued for not doing it, too. This bill opens it up to all land in the state. So suddenly, our folks would have the responsibility for federal and private land. But they would also have the responsibility for figuring out the closest relations or the tribe that the remains belong to, which can be a very difficult thing, requires very expert analysis. We don't do that now. We guess, we try to get the people together to figure out because they would know best. But being required to figure out who these remains belong to is just, takes very, very, you know, heavy science perhaps. Plus just lots of trying to figure out, according to the definitions in here, who is really the closest relation, how do you figure it, and what tribe. There is a definition of tribe in the bill, which also is a concern. I had talked to one of our attorneys about it, and he said he'd be on call. We weren't sure if he was going to be here today, but you know, how does this relate to the ideas that the state has been working on in terms of tribe? But we can't figure out what to do, for instance, because many tribes were nomadic. So if you found human remains, it wouldn't necessarily be that it was the group that lived there now. And it could take a very long time. Well, there's a provision in the bill that would require us to give 3 months' notice. Suppose there was a construction project and they found some remains while they were constructing. We'd have to give 3 months' notice to the relations or to the tribe before the work could continue. But it might take us an awfully long time to figure out who the relations were for the tribe. And so all the work would have to stop. And this would be on native, federal, and state land. And we want to work with a sponsor on this, and we would really ideally like to work and continue to work with you over the summer.
Well, I'd like to hear from Representative Davidson since we have him at the table here.
Mr. Chairman. I have indeed worked very hard for 3 or 4 years now with the department. And I think part of the problem is that I think the attitude is they would like to see the assassination of good public policy in the division by fiscal note. It's a good way to build bureaucracy. But when you ask, we just got a letter the other day and asked, well, how many of these situations did you run into in the last year? There were two. So on the matter of identifying next closest of kin, it's as close as possible. It's not, you know, go take another 10 employees and spend the next 10 years trying to find who these bones belong to. So I think that, you know, with the work that we've done with the department, we've been very patient with the department. We're simply trying to say that if the bones of Aboriginal Alaskans deserve respect, then we should treat them as we would anybody's human remains. And that basically is the intent of the legislation. And of course, we had a situation in Kodiak Island where The Smithsonian Institution took over 800 different individual remains and kept them out of state for a very long period of time. And this legislation would prevent that kind of thing. So I would ask your positive recommendation here and urge you to pass this bill. And the bailiff has come.
What really it concerns me that there isn't some way to get around this, being able to go ahead with a project and preserve the remains at the same time and still, you know, try to identify that. And that's a tough one.
Mr. Chairman, my staff person, Stephanie Love, has been working on this bill, and she can make that explanation
good
for you.
Okay.
If I may be excused, I would. I do not want to be hissed at by my colleagues.
Over there and do good things for people.
Send us a bill or two.
Try
the unprovoked good.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This bill amends the Alaska Historical Preservation Act that's currently in law, and there's direction all through the Alaska Historical Preservation Act on what you do when you find resources of the state.
Okay.
Our bill separates human remains and funerary objects, and some of the earlier parts just adds additional language to the Historical Preservation Act, and then it adds a new section that does say if you come across in a construction site, if you come across an unmarked burial site and human remains, you are either to leave them in place if you can or remove them. And it says to...
what section? Where is that?
Well, let me catch myself here where I am.
It's page 3, lines 17 through 20 are the additions.
It's my understanding, it's from... I don't have Terry Lauder back here, but I understood this section to follow the Alaska Historical Preservation Act's intent, which was... Well, it's current law that they have to have 3 months.
But, Mr.
Notice.
Chairman, there's a difference between determining, notifying someone, a body, to try to figure out what tribe this belonged to. Is not an easy thing. We don't have that expertise.
But I guess I understood that when the remains were found, you would try to leave them interred or you would remove them if construction. I mean, I guess I didn't. Give 3 months of notice of intention
bones
to construct.
Okay.
Well, it's sort of the same situation. If you find human remains in a burial site, you're going to, it's the same, it's a. Defined as a resource today in the definition in the Alaska Historical Preservation Act. Grave sites are included in that today. So this is enough. To give 3 months notice. Okay.
Senator.
Yep. Stephanie, in your opinion, do we have, if we come on a site, if construction comes on a site, then do they have to wait the 3 month period, as Carol's saying?
Our intention. If that's how they're interpreting it, the intention was to, right now in current law, you have to take certain steps in construction sites, construction procedures too. And it says that, this is a notice of private persons portion, but my understanding was that in construction projects, there's already a process in place that they have to follow. And they're supposed to work as rapidly as possible. That's what the current law says. Our intention is only that if you don't have to disinter, then don't. But if you do, the remains can be removed.
And the
process can be continued. But and the our intent was not to have a specific identification either of the remains. If you can't find the closest next of kin, the language says to contact the nearest tribal court. And it is my understanding that the department can tell whether or not remains are of Alaska Native remains or if they are not. But there's that type of expertise from the department.
And Carol, is the way you're interpreting it that the project could stop for a whole 3 months while this is getting sorted out?
Yes, right now. they give, if you're going to dig in an area where there might be something, you give 3 months' notice before you start the construction project, which lets our folks go out there and see if there's anything. But the way this is, if you think there are remains there, we would have to take those remains and determine who they belong to, what tribe. Now, there's a big difference between taking remains and deciding if they're native. That can be done with skeletons and so on, I understand. But to determine which group, prehistoric, for instance, that belongs to, could be a very time-consuming process, and it might never be resolved.
Whether it's Democrats or Republicans, too.
Yeah, yeah. And so that is the way this is worded right now.
It'd be real difficult. Independence.
Stephanie?
I just make the point of the logic that was here. I believe what we were thinking is, it reads that if the department knows that it's a site that there are involves known, reasonably identified remains, then it's the reasonably identified of all. It's not, we aren't asking them to find specific brothers and sisters. If they're known to be Alaskan Natives and they don't have any clue of who the people are, then, or the remains belong to, then the tribal group would be. Tananaw Chiefs, for instance, or the regional corporations, are all happy to be involved. Canada.
If I could ask one more question. Now, Carol, if someone doesn't know that there's remains there and they're on a construction site and there's nothing identified and you're just moving forward with the construction site, like a road or something like that, and you hit some bones and stuff, then the project stops, and then can't you take those remains and move them to an area to move forward with the project, or do you have to sort all that out and the project could be stopped up to a 3 month period of time?
Mr. Chairman, we interpret this, our folks looking at it interpreted this to be that you've got to wait.
That's the way you interpret it?
It's my understanding that there is already in current law, and I guess I'm going to have to find it here, that if there is a grave site, for instance, found during construction, the wording is to work expeditiously to excavate. It's already in law that there's a procedure to follow to get in, and I'll just find it, I guess. Here it is. It's on page, I believe I gave a copy of the Alaska Historical Preservation Act to you in your file. If not, I'll just give you this. It says, if in the course of performing public construction or improvements, historic, prehistoric, or archaeological sites, locations, remains, or objects are discovered, the department shall be notified and its concurrence shall be requested in continuing the construction or improvement. Upon receipt of this notice, the department may survey the area to determine whether the area contains historical, prehistoric, or archaeological data which should be preserved. The survey shall be conducted as expeditiously as possible, as a result of the survey, it's determined that the data exists. Anyway, there's current law that speaks to what you have to do in a construction project.
Senator Frank?
Yeah, you said, or somebody said that the department had two examples of this in the last year. Could you give us some feel for what the department did in these examples?
Mr. Chairman, I have a letter here that was to Representative Davidson from our folks, and I believe there were two. Now, that was on state land, mind you, and this bill would have us do federal land and private land, which greatly increases the scope. It says, in the past 2 years, the Office of History and Archaeology has been involved in two instances of the discovery of unmarked burials as a result of the actions of or referrals by other state agencies. A dot puff road maintenance near Haines. In cooperation with BLM, we helped excavate the skeletons, and a member of the local tribal group was present during excavation. The remains were analyzed, and a report on the physical character of the bones was generated, and the remains were returned to the Chilkoot Native Association for reburial. Part of the cost in this project was paid by DOT. We didn't have to determine what tribe. The locals there said, we'll take them, and that's where they were disposed. The second instance was a referral from the Scientific Crime Detection Laboratory. An individual found a human mandibular fragment in a U.S. Forest Service cabin. The remains probably came from an archaeological site. Because the remains were recovered from federally owned lands, they are currently being held by the OHA until the Chugach National Forest representative takes them.
I believe the discussions, and this bill has been around for 3 years now, and in discussions early on, the feeling was with the Native groups that was that when these remains were found, more than likely there would be associated goods with them that would help identify whether or not it was related to an Alaska Native burial or some type of associated goods along that would help you identify. And the very narrow specifics were not the intent. The intent was to try and just help to show some respect to the remains and allow the Native groups to rebury if they so chose.
Does the department have specific amendments that would clarify and eliminate concerns? Or are we at a standoff on this?
Mr. Chairman, I have about 4 pages of comments that our folks put together on this version. Some of the things need work, and that was why we had hoped to have more time to work on this bill with Representative Davison and his staff. We understand the problem, and we would really like to help. We don't want the things that happened in the past to occur, but we think things perhaps can be removed, make it more generalized, put the responsibility, but maybe not the requirement to determine what tribe it is, to coordinate, things like that. I don't have any amendments at this time that are going to cure all the problems. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know this bill's been around about 3 or 4 years. Have you been working in the dialogue and you still can't come to some agreement on this? Or has it been hit and miss or what?
Mr. Chairman, our archaeologists have been working with Ms. Love on this. And if you've ever talked to archaeologists from the
I can respond to that. We've worked on this bill intensely for 2 years. It was much more complicated than it is today. It had a number of concerns that the Alaskan Native groups expressed, and we condensed it. This is a much, much more condensed version that just addresses what their basic concerns are. But this language comes from the compromise and the hours of teleconference work sessions that I did with the people involved, and this was the final product.
And this is the best.
This was the final product, and a lot of the earlier language, like. I didn't interpret. This is Terry Lauterbach's language that amends the current law about the 3 months notice, and I didn't interpret that to mean that it would stop construction for 3 months. But
I wonder, do you have a ledge legal opinion on that?
A
sectional
on this one?
On that, right. What do they say about could we add some purposes?
Yeah.
Could we get some kind of opinion from them, or we will?
On whether or not it would stop?
That seems to be the.
That's a technical bill, probably technically.
I could ask
stumbling point in this whole procedure.
I need to get a hold of Johnny to supplemental on here.
I think my explanation to this page 3, section 6, is that currently they're already asked in current law to give 3 months' notice.
Yeah.
It's asking if it involves known is the key word to mean, because they have their index of sites right now. The state index of where certain potential remains are.
Yeah, so one thing to know before you go in. Another thing to encounter it as when you're in the middle of the project.
So my interpretation of this section was when they give the notice to the original 3 months notice that they're going to go in, and the site is known to have historic remains on it, it would be in parallel. Then the new section speaks to what you do when you find new sites. That's how I interpret this. And so maybe maybe I'll ask Terry Lauder back to get something to you, and we'll come back to Section 6, because that's not how I interpreted it.
Yeah, I think it would be helpful. We had a...
The concern is whether it would hold construction up for 3 months?
Right, right. We had a...
Once it was initiated?
Right. What happens, you know, when you hit something, encounter something during the course of the project? Is it a 3 month waiting period? We shut it down. Is there any way that we can, you know, remove the artifacts or the human remains? Get the identification and still go ahead with the project. I guess that's. Can you do that?
And I will ask
Senator. Okay, Stephanie, the way your intent in this was that the project would not stop for 3 months.
Well, the current law deals with that, and it was my understanding that along with what they currently do, another process would be to separate human remains from whatever else they find. Sometimes they don't find the human remains, so this part of law would not come into effect. Because it's not speaking only to funerary items. That's not our intent. Our intent is associated funerary goods with the human remains. So the process is already in place that they follow with construction projects. They're supposed, according to DOT, when they go in to do a project, a road project, etc., there's built in to that is the RSA, whatever it is that the department will have the DNR, DOT will have DNR come in and do the excavation. And so we're just saying that when the excavation is done, human remains are as closely identified as possible, and if they are Alaska Native remains, if the burial site is not known to be a specific burial site, then you would contact the nearest tribal group and allow them to rebury them. That's the gist of this legislation. And it also protects someone from coming in and just taking. You have to ask the Native groups whether or not you can remove them.
Senator Lassen.
What if they're Russians?
If they're Russians, well, it's my understanding.
No.
Mm-hmm, it's my understanding that the DNR does have the capability to maybe not specifically to family identify remains, but you are able to tell. And some of the tribal groups have said that they would bury all remains. But specifically, most historical remains are Alaska Native. But given it's true that there are prospectors and everyone else too, so it deals with all remains. And I guess it would follow the normal procedures of what they do when they find remains today.
Senator Frank.
What is that they do if they find the normal course of business without the law? What do we do now, I guess?
Mr. Chairman, we coordinate. If there are fresh remains, then the troopers take care of it. And if they determine it's something that's very old, they contact, if it's even no matter what land it is, they usually contact our state historic preservation officer. And if it's on federal or native land, she tells the troopers who that is. If it's on our land, what she does is they either go out there and inspect the site where it is. If it's on a construction site that DOT is doing, DOT will pay for this, or maybe the remains were picked up and moved and brought in. They can identify from a skeleton whether it's native or not. Usually there are some characteristics, I guess, I don't understand, but they say they can. Someone there has expertise. But beyond that, they don't know. So what they would do is contact any local groups who this might be related to, and they get them involved, and then it's those groups that decide what to do with the remains. We don't decide which one gets them. I mean, we try to get the locals to work it out themselves. We aren't required to decide, and we just try to work it out to make everyone happy. And we would like to continue doing that, really. And that's why the wording in here, you know, I know the intent that Ms. Love just expressed is the kind of thing that we do and would like to continue to do. Once we get into statutory requirements, you know how easy it is to stop a project by suing someone, and there are just lots more possibilities here for anyone to be sued because the remains weren't going to the right person, and that really does concern us. I don't think that's their intention. I'm sure it isn't, but we wind up with that problem.
Senator Weiss?
What if, for instance, a miner was out Fairbanks starting his spring dig and he runs across a few bones in the dig? What's going to happen, and when can he continue his work? I mean, what would happen?
As our bill would read, public safety has asked us to put language in the Title 12 change. You wouldn't stop your activity, but you would notify the, you would stop activity. Cease activity that would cause further disturbance of the area and then report the presence of the, if he's out in the field and he's not going to come back in, he would report it when he came back in, but he wouldn't disturb the area where the remains were.
He'd have to quit work and come back
in that
and
area.
It.
He would have to stop where the remains were.
And then what happens?
And then if public safety determines that it is not a murder or something fairly fresh, if it's historical, then DNR would be called in, which is the process today.
And then what would DNR do?
We would try
when
to
can
find
he get
out.
Back to work? I guess that's that's the bottom line.
If it's a site that they think there might be something historic there, they'd go out and look and make sure it was okay to continue, that they weren't destroying a house site or something like that. But if it was just, say, these bones out there, we might say, well, we don't know whose they are. There's no group around here. They're not native. Why don't you bury them? Or
but I thought they had to make a reasonable effort to determine who they were.
In the spill, they would.
That's what I mean. And then how long would that take?
Looks
when
like
could this miner get back to work? I guess it appears to me that he might not make it.
Well,
it might be a Russian.
I guess the key then is to cease activity in that area. And the intent is to leave remains interred.
Well, you know what the effect's going to be. You know, somebody's just going to keep on doing what they're doing, and they're not going to tell anybody when they find something, probably. I mean, that's probably what's going to happen, I guess. You know.
Yep, such bones.
Dog bones, eh? Yeah, after all that work.
Well, you know, I mean, that's sometimes the effect of the law isn't what happens. I mean, you know, sometimes you make a law that you think is going to do one thing, and it winds up doing another thing, because you know, if you know the state and the feds are going to come down and shut your operation down, I don't know. I don't know what would happen, but some people would find it scary to notify the authorities, I'm sure, to be practical.
I guess my only response to that would be that that's current law. It's a Class A misdemeanor today to go into state to resources such as a grave or something. So we're just amending the current law. We're not saying that this is going to be new laws. They're already. It's a Class A misdemeanor. And people rob sites today. You know that they do digs. I guess only expanding on it for human remains.
But robbing known sites is one thing, isn't it? I mean, and then that's different than running into something unknown and a project. And
I believe that there's leniency in this bill. I don't think that it's being so specific. I think the department has leniency. Uh-huh. We're not asking them to be specific to a leg bone. We're speaking about unmarked burial sites is what we're talking about, and especially in relation to the Smithsonian situation.
Now, Mr. Chairman, I don't think that this really would stop any type of development. I think there was an example here on Kodiak the last year, the year before, where they were putting in a power line from the transformer site there in Kodiak out to Cape Chinyak, and in one instance they did drill the hole and ran into some artifact or something out there, and immediately I think the state sent in the geologists and whatnot, and they monitored the activity going on so that there would be a minimal amount of disturbance, and they were able to go ahead and put the pole in there and then continue with the rest of the project. So I don't think that it does stop anything there, you know, permanently, and you know, they were still able to continue with the project and finish it on schedule as far as I know.
Senator Lassen.
I guess if we're talking about artifacts on one hand and we're talking about bones on the other, bones are not considered artifacts, right? Unless they're something that's with those
the
bones.
The grave site is what's considered the resource.
The grave site?
And that's what the
even
grave site.
Even if there's only bones there?
Well,
for example,
I guess
couldn't someone who's doing this see it as human remains, they are bones, they could put them in a box or something, save them for determination of really what it was or who they are, as long as there weren't artifacts there, they couldn't continue to work, or everything has to stop?
Well, it says to leave them interred when you discover them, not to take them out of the ground if you don't have to. But it doesn't say that you can't take them out of the ground.
What difference does it really make as long as you're
take
the effort to collect them, set them aside, get them out of the work area, and there's no artifacts, all there is bones from the human remains. And some later date they can determine, if they can, who this person was.
Mm-hmm.
But we can't do that under this bill.
Well, In current law, you can't do it either. It says you have to leave them interred if you can, and if you can't, you bring the department in, and they then would take them out. It's just amending the current law.
Well, what's wrong with the current law then? I guess that's
because all this bill does is separate out of the definition of resource. There's a number of different resource definitions. It separates human remains from gravesite, so that you and it's to respect the dead and let them be reburied, I guess, is the intent behind it.
Oh, I got you.
Mr. Chairman, I think I could add something to that. The problem started when human remains left Kodiak and were sent back to Smithsonian or something, and the line between, I guess, what is an archaeological treasure and what is someone, a person who
right.
should be treated with respect is pretty fine, and I think that was the original intent of the bill, to clarify that. And federal land and private land was dragged in because the feds didn't want to honor that
right.
premise that if you found remains, they weren't to be displayed in the Smithsonian, they were to be reburied with respect. And we don't really object to that. There are those scientists out there that say, but wait a minute, this might be really important to determining who crossed the land bridge or something like that, that there should perhaps in some instances be a possibility of examining the remains, but then of course burying them eventually, not putting them in a museum. But and so there's all sorts of...
Why can't, I mean, when you come across these remains, why can't you just take them, set them aside, and determine what, and go ahead with the project, and then rebury them with respect at a different time? And I don't understand what the problem is.
I'm not so sure that you can't do that today. I think it's the department's call whether or not you do it. Along with the, if they're found, you have to, it says in current law you have to stop construction. So it's, you know, I think it all depends on interpretation, site-specific case by specific case.
I think there's a tremendous difference between a historical burial spot than there is a casual pile of bones over here and over there, and someone might have died in a trail and they were buried. But if it is a tribal place where people have been brought to be entombed, that's entirely different than finding bones out there in the mining areas. And I think that even though they are, there is that separation, they should be treated in a reasonably good manner. But I can understand not disturbing an area which is actually a burial ground. You know, nobody wants to go into there, but the casual people out there,
I don't know why
we should stop them.
Right up north in the permafrost, it's my understanding that you see human remains all the time. And it's my understanding that the process would be, if you see them, you would contact law enforcement. And from that point on, the law enforcement would come in and see maybe that it's a historical site. DNR would then say, I mean, we're not asking them if they find a couple of bones to tear them all out, to leave them interred. And if it's possible that they're not interrupted in a, like you're speaking about miners, but I'm sure there's a number of different situations that it comes up. It's all specific to the situation. If it's a road and they're going to have to put the road through, then they just call in the native group if it becomes a burial. It's the burials that we're speaking of, too. It's not a bone here or a bone there.
What's the experience out there in handling or how long it takes to determine whether or not it's a burial ground or is it just some remains that are incidental to that?
Mr. Chairman, that's the problem of the fiscal note. Right now, we're pretty much limited to the person running the project, if it's DOT, and that's the primary thing in the state, paying for us to go out there and look. And to cover federal land and native land, we don't have any money to do that. And we've thought, gee, maybe the landowner should pay for this. But there's no provision for that. And there's no provision, we put in our fiscal note some of the expertise and some of the money to travel and so on. But we couldn't do that now.
Mm-hmm.
So it would have to stop, I assume, until we could get around to it.
Say one more thing, I guess. In talking to public safety and the discussions that we had a couple of years ago, it's been probably 2 years now because this is the third year, public safety said they were happy to take care of the travel because it's a response action that they're required to do, and they would be happy to take someone from DNR to the site if that was the situation. And I think something out in the bush, compared to a construction project that's going to be in the urban area, it's going to be a lot easier to get to that urban site than it is to the bush site. And so it's a site by site. How do you feel?
Senator Lester, why didn't we start off a step at a time, say, for example, those burial sites that are true burial sites, tribal sites, or ancestral sites, so they might be those the ones that get this treatment first to see how that works before we expand it into the single body somewhere in a not a burial area.
So I can understand everybody, I think, would certainly agree that those particular sites should be handled very delicately and carefully, but finding a single person out somewhere doesn't really make a lot of sense going through all this rigmarole and find out he's one of the 49ers that came up looking for gold and didn't find any, so he stayed there. And in the meantime, Steve Frank's miners can't work for 3 months. Those types, can't you sort of start off small and see how it works before you get private land involved and before you get stopping construction jobs in the middle of summer? Those types of problems that I think you're going to run across.
Well, I guess I'm not the one to respond to that. It was a working group that put this bill together, and so...
Well, it might have been a working group, but you certainly didn't have DNR along with you.
No, we did have DNR. Judy Bittner, who is Schiphol's office, she worked with us, along with a number of her people, anthropologists, archaeologists, whatever
then,
they are.
Yeah, but DNR still had objections to what was...
I mean, it seems like you haven't got it put together yet, though.
Well, I guess there comes a point where Representative Davidson made a decision on what the bill would say, so that's where we are.
Senator Roth.
Mr. Chairman, it kind of sounds like this is the same thing as that limited entry bill we had. I don't care what you do to it, it's not going to make the department happy at all. And I don't think that they're going to find a compromise to it. I mean, we've heard this argument before that if there is a reason for us to go out somewhere and we can't afford to do it, it's going to take us much longer to do that, and we'll do it on our own good, sweet time. Yeah. That doesn't make sense anymore. You know, this...
Yeah, well, I wonder if this makes sense, though, to start shutting down projects over some bones. You don't even know if it's a burial ground or it's just incidental bones or what it is.
Well, it seems to me, Mr. Chairman, that the project is going to shut down anyway. I mean, as soon as you're out there, and unless I'm wrong, if you're out there working, you run across an archaeological site, that you have to report that, and the work stops until you get some indication to move ahead on that.
It's a current law. So
you have to do that.
That's current law.
It's current law.
If you continue to work, then you're in violation of that law.
So in that case, then what's DNR's problem?
If they found bones there, we would have to go out and determine, and we don't have the expertise within the department.
Wait a minute. Under current law, you don't have to go out and determine?
We don't have to determine if there's a tribe or even really if they're native. I mean, we try to do that to help because our folks have the expertise on the skeleton. But we don't have to determine what tribe these folks belong to, and we're not required to return them to the tribe or the closest kin or whatever. So this adds a whole new layer of responsibility. How we do it now is we go out there, and if we think this is something that, you know, maybe we haven't even, we get the local community, we get the local native organizations, whatever, to come and look at the site and say, are these yours, and what can we do? So it's a coordination process. I mean, we don't just pick them up, cast them aside. We don't do that. We're not the problem, as I understand it.
While you're doing this, and the operation shut down.
You said it's the feds is the problem?
It was federal land, I believe, that the bodies from Kodiak were taken from. I don't think anyone's complained about us. Perhaps they have, but...
Mr. Chairman, that was 1930, wasn't it?
It was in the 30s.
Are they still doing that sort of thing?
We permit on state land for going out to scientists and so on to look at archaeological sites. So we control the state land. There are federal permits on federal land, and our state historic preservation officer has some involvement because she kind of watches over the federal laws for the feds. But if we find or if someone on a dig finds remains, we don't have that responsibility of determining who they are. Again, we try to help out because we don't want these cast aside, but this gives us the responsibility. And the thing is, we don't have the expertise to determine what tribe. So even if public safety or someone else paid our way out there, the most we could figure out is these are native bones. We'd have to hire someone, get a contractor, a consultant, whatever, to figure out what tribe. Now we can just say to the locals, take these, we think they're yours, and usually they'll say yes. But that wouldn't suffice under this law, and that's our concern.
The new language would give them tiered responsibility. If they can find the closest kinship, then you would notify them. If they find that they're native, then you can ascertain the closest kin, then that's great. That's the best scenario. And, but if you can and it's not reasonably identified, then it asks you to contact the nearest tribal group. So it gives them some leeway. It doesn't mandate that they have to, in my, I don't believe. It gives them leeway to just contact still. I guess, and I'm calling, pulling off of conversations from 2 years ago, what I recall in those discussions, but the department acknowledged the fact that they do this today and didn't feel that it was necessary to be put in law. So it might be a little bit more specific than they'd like to see, but it's a result of this working group that worked a lot of hours on it.
Well, they don't want that to happen. Let's
see why.
Yes. Well, the Smithsonian remains have been returned and reburied, and the federal law has been changed also.
Yeah.
They have to be returned.
So right today, we don't have the same problem that we had with.
It's not on the same level today, and the discoveries, as Judy Bittner has explained, is very rare in the past 2 years, two sites. So we don't think it's going to really put that much extra burden on the department.
I'd like to get that legal, that's
okay.
Legal opinion on that section. 6, page 3.
No ban.
Stick around, do a third supplemental tonight.
Exactly. You know exactly when it does.
Okay.
Bill 369, posting of sound prices.
Which one are we going with?
369, posting prices.
This is not a price. Is it good at the moment?
Connect to that. No, they're going to do it.
I don't know.
369, there's an amendment to it. Let's hear from them.
For the record, my name is Bryce Edgman. I'm staff with Representative Jacko, who's not able to be here. The House is still in session. I'd like to briefly describe the bill that's in front of you. But what this bill does is it includes current salmon prices on fish tickets and all premises where salmon is bought and sold, and that would be both onshore premises, canneries, and so forth, and offshore, including tenders and whatever. The bill has the support of the United Fishermen Association, and the Department of Fish and Game has taken a neutral stance on this. It does have zero fiscal notes from Fish and Game, as well as revenue and the Department of Public Safety. House Bill 369 passed the House unanimously, 40-0. It was heard in the Resources Committee over there, and amended and also amended in Labor and Commerce. His original version called for preseason prices 120 days before the start of the season, which was subsequently amended in Resources to 60 days and then taken out in the Labor and Commerce Committee. Just asked that fish buyers include the current price on the fish tickets as well as wherever salmon is bought and sold. With that brief explanation, I'd be open to any questions.
Rick Barber, we have an amendment that's.
I did fail to mention the intent language that was in the document.
Right, we have intent language.
Did
also.
The House adopt that?
No, that wasn't.
Are you recommending intent language?
Yes, we are.
I think what we have here is intent language that says essentially what the amendment says. I think the sponsor would rather see intent language rather than amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Rick Lauber. I represent Pacific Seafood Processors Association. The bill and its form in which it reaches this body causes me some concern in that it could significantly change the method of doing business between fishermen and processors. The amendment takes care of a significant portion of my concern which was it could, there at least was some doubt as to whether it would discourage payment of bonuses or postseason adjustment in salmon prices, which, as you're well aware, is the normal way of doing business. I'm not so sure that it still, even with the amendment, would take care of the concern I have regarding the quest for quality that we're currently engaged in the industry, and that there is a various prices that are paid sometimes at the time of purchase. The exact price is not known until the fish are run through the processing plant, and there could be later adjustments. I would presume that the amendment would take care of that. The second section of the bill, the posting of salmon prices, really I don't think is a major concern to me, except that where it might be that there is no price, but the fish are purchased on an open ticket, which is, of course, what you're trying to take care of in the amendment. I don't really see that this is a major problem for the industry either, whether this bill passes or whether it fails, quite frankly. It's been going on for well over 100 years under the current system, and it's not going to do a heck of a lot to change the situation where fishermen think they ought to get more money and processors think they ought to give less. But if somebody has to have this bill for some reason or other, I guess big enough of a boy to see that that's the situation. But I'm also concerned that we not merely adopt the intent language, although I think that we should probably do both. The reason for that is that this is the type of a bill where there aren't going to be any regulations. What you see is what you get. 10, 15, 20 years down the line, if this isn't in the bill, people are going to pick up the statute, read it, and there's going to be confusion. And quite likely, most of us here aren't going to be around to explain the situation to anybody, particularly out in the field. And there is a similar language. When we passed a law that would be purchased of fish by the pound, for your information, years ago, salmon in some areas of the state were purchased by the fish and not by the pound. There was similar language as to this amendment. That and the reason for that is it's used today where a vessel, usually it's in bad weather conditions, the vessel run up to a tender, and it's difficult for them to use the scales because they can't get true weights because of the rolling and pitching and so forth. So the fisherman is notified that they deliver to that tender that they will be given what's usually called a tender average. In other words, the fish are eventually weighed, but they're not segregated per fisherman. So therefore, you get whatever the tender average is for sockeye or chums or whatever the fish are. And this is in the statute, and everyone can see it, and they know what the situation is. And I understand what the letter of intent comes from the prime sponsor of the bill. Probably be no objection when it's read across on the other body. I presume that they would concur immediately in the amendments if they're made in this body, and I think it would go a long ways toward resolving any problems years down the line when somebody's just picking up the statute. And if it isn't in there, there can be some confusion, and I don't think we want to do anything to make it any more difficult for fishermen and processors to reach agreement and sell their fish. And with that, I would be happy to respond to.
Senator Cox?
I'm looking at the intent language and then the amendment, and they're almost the same.
Yes.
They're not quite the same. The one difference I see is in the intent language, it says that it appears to say that you'd still have to post a price on the fish ticket, but that if you had a written agreement, you wouldn't have to pay that price. Your amendment says that if you have another written agreement, you don't have to post a price on the fish ticket.
Well, that's I was unaware of that, Senator.
You see what I mean?
Yeah. If that's the case, then that's a pretty cool move on the part of somebody. I do not have the intent language. I was told that the intent language merely mirrored and I took a quick glance at it, but I don't have it.
One thing that comes to mind, how do you know that there's been a prior agreement?
Well, in this case, there is it says in writing. A way I would see it probably operating would be that at the time of the sale, on so-called open ticket, and where I see this would happening is that if a fisherman and a processor wish to enter into an agreement, and this is not uncommon where, particularly among small processors, will say, I will pay what the big boys pay. The fisherman fishes for that processor, goes fishing, and delivers his fish. When the price is arrived at in that particular area, then that's the price that he's credited with. Also, as you know, post-season, for instance, in Bristol Bay, there was a lot of hue and cry about the price. It was substantially lower, but yet the post-season bonuses are running about 7 cents, 8 cents a pound in addition to what they were paid. Obviously, we don't want to discourage that.
Well, the second sentence in your amendment takes care of that. So if you post dollar pound and later want to pay me an extra for high quality or season bonus, or if you promised in writing to pay me a nickel more than the other guy, you could still do that. But I'm still confused about this first sentence. And
that's the one that I believe would take care of the situation where a fisherman is delivering fish on what in the business I believe is referred to as an open ticket. Right. There is no fixed price. There may be some agreement as to how that price is arrived at, as the one I mentioned, that I will pay whatever the final settlement price is, or in Bristol Bay, quote, or something of that nature. The other thing is that in Prince William Sound for many years, I don't know if they're still doing it, but Prince William Sound had a method of paying they had a percentage that was, I guess you could call it an advance, and then they had a sliding scale, and in fact it's in statute so that they can do it. It's based upon how much the fish sold for. And then this is, there's a written agreement agreed to by the Cordova Fisheries Union or something, and the processors that sign it, as to how you arrive at that final price. And of course, co-ops, which are also mentioned in this statute, my understanding, pay an advance, and then they make a final adjustment when they sell the fish, and they know how much money they make. And that price may be larger or smaller than what the fishermen that sell to a cash buyer would be. But they wait, and this could be 6 months, or in some cases, over a year before they know.
Senator Lyson.
Well, I think Rick's right when he says that really not, it's not going to make a lot of difference. He's also right in saying I think people like to see legislation go through with their names on it. I think he's right also that one way to stop this is to make a pitch at the last minute and it gets hung up in some limbo file, nothing happens. And there's all kinds of things being done here, and it really doesn't affect Southeastern. But I guess there was one thing that was pointed out to me by my staff person, is the fact that if there is going to be some positive thing about this, if they post a price, Bristol Bay. Of course, everyone knows that, you know, that's not the end of the price, that's just the start. And somebody quotes a price of 50 cents a pound of sockeye, even though he knows he's going to pay 75 or 80. The one next door is going to post a price of 55 cents a pound, even though he's going to pay 80. So that brings those buyers into a competitive situation, and someone maybe over here is going to post 70 cents a pound, even though they're all going to pay 80. Then over here, those fish, they sell to the 70, and it creates an environment where there's competition, and maybe at the end, maybe instead of getting 80, they get a dollar. That's one positive aspect of this bill. Otherwise, it don't mean a lot. But I guess my concern is, I'm sure it's a concern of the prime sponsor, is that it's my understanding, a house they have a what they call a limbo file. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We don't have, because it's not a fair way to deal with issues. that's fine. And I understand that file is getting quite full, and once it gets to the point that they run out of time and pulling bills out of the limbo file, the bills that don't make are not large biggies for the group, but might be big for somebody who's been working on a bill for 2 years, might not get pulled out of the limbo file. So I guess the question before this body is whether or not we're going to maybe draft this intent language, which I think will do the same thing as the amendment, because it's really not doing a lot. But it would avoid dead on arrival from any other body. They can adopt an unamended bill with letter of intent, and he's got it. I don't see anything wrong with that.
Yeah.
Honesty and fairness wins again.
On the intent language, the intent language, though.
I don't know, mate.
Do we
want to
make it so the intent language is the same as the amendment?
No, I don't think so. I think Sam pretty well identified that there's not going to be any posted price if there is prior agreement. I think the posted price is probably the only redeeming part of this bill. It might create an atmosphere of competition.
They don't post the price at all. I mean, they just say verbally what they'll give you, or they don't say what they'll give you?
Well, typically, you have your choice of buyers, and I'm just familiar with my own area, but there'll be three buyers, and I'll go visit them all and, you know, go on what they say they're going to pay and their experience. And so I know what I'm getting.
Verbally? Verbal?
Yeah, verbally. And, but like Rick says, and sometimes it's going to be, I'll pay you a nickel over the other guy, whatever he finally pays you. So I make sure I sell some to each of them, you know, so I'll know what this guy paid, so I'll know what what my rebate's going to be.
Is that called covering your bases?
Yep.
I understand this. It does call for a posted price.
Yeah, it's going to be a change. I mean, it's going to be an interesting situation if a buyer has to post a price. I mean, I think it's got potential for change, but it's also, you know, it's going to put the processors in a new spot, and I don't really think it's going to hurt, but it's going to be interesting. It's going to be different, and I don't think it's anti-competitive. I think it's probably going towards the, you know, pro-competition side of things, but. Well, Rick says they've been doing things like this for 100 years, though. Boy, old habits die hard.
Mr. Chairman, I disagree. If you adopt the intent language in the form in which it's in, what you have done is you've stopped fishermen from entering into agreements with processors where there is not a listed price, where there's not a price that they agreed to pay.
Huh?
And that's
we can,
if you want to talk about Bristol Bay, that's a significant factor. And there's a number of fishermen that have fished, did not go along with the boycott in Bristol Bay, and this has happened other places. People that decided they wanted to fish they did so, and they ended up receiving whatever price that processor paid them. And I think that is something that people should be able to do. If there is no price, but still someone has a relationship with their buyer that they feel comfortable with, I think that they should be entitled to go fishing.
Mm-hmm.
And by passing this legislation and this intent language, you're making it a point that you cannot have a relationship like that any longer. And as I said, I think that you're changing situations where some of the current arrangements and maybe in other places in the state.
The legislation doesn't prevent the payment of bonuses, postseason adjustments, other forms of compensation.
No, that's correct.
So whatever the price is paid, you could still have an agreement for those types of things beyond the current price that's posted, right?
Well, obviously with the intent language, presumably you could, but I think that my statement has some merit in that my understanding of the way most people in the fish business look, they don't have a stack of Senate and House journals in their offices and fishermen in their organizations, and down the line, people aren't going to remember this, and it could create problems for them. I think you ought to put it in the language. And by the way, I didn't mousetrap anybody on this. I informed the other body of my position, and they thought that they had a better chance of running it through apparently without it and didn't like it. I'm not coming in here with something that I have objected to. I did object to the 120 days, and I did object to the 60 days.
But I just want to get straight. Are you saying that you cannot have a written agreement if we pass this with an individual fisherman?
Well, it says listed current price. That presupposes there is a listed current price.
Yep.
And I'm saying that the situation I'm concerned about, where there is no established price, the price is to be established at some later time or through some other mechanism.
But, I mean, even though there's a posted price, current price, can't you still have an... You don't have to have an agreement with an individual fisherman for that current price, do you? I mean, can't you still do that? Even though this, I mean, does this say you can't do that? That's what I want to know. I don't see that here, I guess. Let me ask this question.
How do you deal with an area there that that fishes and they get their fish right here and they haven't settled on a price? They base their price on what the price is somewhere else at some later point, and you don't know what that listed price is. Now, Sitka, for example, may catch their fish earlier than Ketchikan, and then their fishermen may agree that our price is going to be 10 cents a pound more than what they get in Ketchikan, but we don't know what they're going to get in Ketchikan because they haven't received the fish there yet. And so that causes a little bit of a problem. And then I guess another question I have is, what are the penalties if you're a tender out there and you've got all these boats waiting to offload, and you're going through all these fish tickets, you know, signing them out, and then about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, your tally man forgets to, when he puts it on there, forgets to fill out the price. What is the penalty if the fisherman comes up here raising an issue later on and says, they didn't put a price on my ticket? What is the penalty against the processor at that point, or the tender, or the individual that filled out the ticket?
Triple damages.
Yeah, treble damages.
Are you asking me?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, we're asking somebody to do something, and if they don't do it, what is the penalty for not doing it? Maybe the sponsor knows on that.
Yeah.
Well, the original bill stated that there was a
price. Yeah.
It would be a misdemeanor and $1,000 fine if you violated
the... Hey, here's your penalty.
It's my understanding that, I certainly couldn't clarify that without having George Udomo here, but that would be a similar situation with this bill. Although, just talking to Jaron Bruce, to his understanding, it wouldn't be against the law to not include that.
Senator Lyason?
I don't see where it precludes a processor saying, we're going to pay you at least 60 cents a pound. However, as far as we're concerned, today the price is 25 cents a pound, and that's posted. And someone else could say, well, we're going to pay you at least 60 cents a pound. The price, as far as we're concerned today, is 5 cents higher than the posted price fellow next door. Now, there's nothing precludes this from happening. They're certainly not going to say, we're going to pay you this, and when they know they can't pay it, they're going to start at a low figure. But it seems to me in this process, it's going to be a competitive situation if they want to get the fish. I mean, it just makes That's human nature. And somewhere in the end of this process, maybe they might be getting close to what the fish are worth. I don't know.
It used to be an accepted practice in Bristol Bay where all the tenders would have their prices posted on it. You could go up to the Iggy Yake River and you could virtually do comparative shopping, just motor up past all the processors. And all the canneries on shore used to have a posted by the bunkhouse or by the cookhouse or wherever what the current prices were. And even back then, those days, who the high boat for the fishermen, or who the high boat fishermen were, the canneries were. But of course, things have changed, and the market situation has changed. But one of the key elements of the strike on Bristol Bay last year was that there wasn't any flow of information at all. That's no right. Indication of what prices might be.
But the flip side of this is that particular fisherman who does not have an agreement which says he's going to get at least 80 cents a pound, and he goes into this buyer and says, the buyer says, as far as we're concerned, the price today is 40 cents a pound. He sells his fish. And he comes back in the next month and says, where's my bonus? And the buyer says, well, I didn't have an agreement with you. The price that day was 40 cents, and that's exactly what you're getting.
Right on.
The fishermen have sold fish more than once, you know.
So, I mean, there's a flip side to it, too. But I don't think there's anything wrong with somebody knowing what they're going to get, at least have an idea when they sell something.
Well, is it... You know, practical matter, 99% of the fish is going to be sold exactly the way Senator Eliason says. I'm not arguing that point. In most of the cases, there probably wouldn't be any problem with putting some price in the fish ticket. By the way, the whole fish ticket legislation has nothing to do with price. Fish ticket legislation is in there for a management tool. It's a resource management method so that fish and game knows how much fish are caught, so forth, and rapidly, and that type of thing. This is an add-on that somebody's going to have to do something additional to. Now, you can fill in the price on the fish ticket.
There's a place for it.
There is a place, and this, they say that as in a general practice, that isn't the final price of the fish.
Right.
You hope it isn't the final price of the fish because you want a bonus.
Right. Well, but like, for instance, my case, well, this is just anecdotal, but last year there was three buyers. One of them said 80, the other said 90, the other one said a dollar. So I sold the guy who was given a dollar. Plus, I had an agreement with him for another 7 cents because I iced. Well, I got the dollar.
And seven?
I didn't get the seven.
You're going to sell the next year?
Not him. But still, I made out better because I got a dollar ground price. The other guys were only offering 80 and 90 anyway. So even though he cheated me, he still did better than selling the other guys.
Yeah. No, but Senator, the guy was paying 90 paid a 12 cent bonus.
No, I sold some of them too. Make sure.
Yeah. And you didn't see the bonus?
No, I got him. Actually, he paid 80 and then I had 9 later.
Well, I guess Sir Weiss hits it. I'm afraid if we mend this thing, it probably doesn't pass. It probably kills it.
Sort of like a true supporter of fishery bills.
Oh, yeah.
If we're going to amend it, let's make a minimum price. There you go. But if there you get an amendment, then you have problems. Yeah. Maybe Rick could come up with some compromise intent language which would go along with this, and everybody would be happy.
Okay.
I mean, why not?
Yeah. Sounds good to me right now.
I know he wants the bill. Tell by the way
you want. You got a suggestion on a different intent language?
I don't have any problem with either, except I just don't want to amend the bill.
We'll step out.
Okay, you got about 5 minutes. We're going to walk a little technical session.
So they're going to work on intent language, but meanwhile you can pass the bill.
You say whatever you want to do. Are they going to work on intent language?
They're going to have, like, let's put them under pressure and get it done.
Yeah, I'm sure he really wants it.
Well, you get the bill anyway.
Let's hear House Bill 207.
Do you want me to tell him that we just had
it? Mr. Chairman and members of the Senate Resources Committee, for the record, my name is Sandra Borbridge, aide to Representative Lincoln. Since she couldn't be here today, she asked that I give a brief statement and answer any questions you might have. House Bill 207 amends the definition of village under state statutes pertaining to the Village Safe Water Program eligibility list for funding. The current definition includes an unincorporated community which has between 25 and 600 people residing within a 2-mile radius or a second-class city. House Bill 207 would add first-class cities with not more than 600 residents. The impacted communities would include Seldovia, Tanana, St. Mary's, Pelican, Heidelberg, and Yakutat. These six villages are similarly situated to other villages that are now eligible for Village Safe Water funding. It is solely their status as first-class cities that precludes them from receiving funds under the Village Safe Water Program. Most of these communities that are now first-class cities were organized in that status in order to operate their own school districts, and we don't believe that that was intended to bar them from VSW funding. House Bill 207 was introduced at the request of one of our villages in House District 24 with a population of 491 in rural Alaska, referred to as a village, and has water and sewer as a top priority for funding. Right now, the only way these villages that are similarly situated to St. Mary's can receive funding for water and sewer projects is either through a direct 100% legislative grant or through the 50% matching grant program in DEC. Although we are encouraging our villages to look at ways of providing local contributions, 50% of a project that may run as high as $1 or $2 million is beyond their capabilities, and that's why the Village Safe Water Program was put into existence. There's a zero fiscal note attached to this bill. No additional funding would be required to implement its provisions. As stated earlier, the six villages added to the program, if this bill passes, are similarly situated to those already on the list, and this has been supported by the Department of Community and Regional Affairs for that reason. The Village Safe Water Program is a good SAM program, and by including these villages for funding, they would go through a review under DEC and would also become eligible for the Remote Maintenance Worker Program services. And we feel that it would benefit not only these six villages, but the state in the long run.
Senator Bernard.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know the 600 is existing law. Is there anything magical about that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Menard, we just went through and added that because the 600 number was already in the statutes for an incorporated community.
Any further questions? Thank you.
Close the hearing. I'll move House Bill 207 out with individual recommendations.
Any objections to order? Do you want to check and see if that language?
You didn't move anything else out?
Out of scenery.
Did you move anything else out?
We moved out that daycare administrator thing. And we moved out Richard Foster's bill on Native Corporations dissolution, Green State.
How about out of here?
I don't think we moved anything.
We moved 411 out.
You moved 411 out?
Yeah.
We left record. Yeah, get up here.
Okay. All right. We're going with the intent language, and it would read, it is the intent of the 7th legislature that this legislation does not mandate the and strike payment, and it would read, of a listed current price, if a prior written agreement exists, and then add between the seller and the buyer. So reading it all together, it would read, it is the intent of the 7th legislature that this legislation does not mandate a listed current price if a prior written agreement exists between the seller and the buyer, and the second paragraph would stay in as is. I guess it would strike, we're striking, it would not mandate, and strike the payment of and add a
right.
Listed current price, I guess for...
Does not mandate a listed current price if a prior written agreement exists between a seller and a buyer.
Right.
Okay. House Bill 369.
Mr. Chairman, I'll make the motion that we move the bill from committee along with the letter of intent, conceptual letter of intent. All right. No objections. So ordered. We stand adjourned.